outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
Wayne, my world has sped up a little bit.
Thought we had a good talk about depacing your life a bit.
Yes, that was the vision, that was the dream, but it actually is a bit of an update. I mentioned a little while ago that I've been working on a four-year degree from my college, and we were planning on presenting that to the Wyoming Community College Commission for final approval in February of next year.
Good pace on that. That's good. Yes, yeah. Good timing. I like that.
Lots of wide open space.
Yeah.
Well, then we had a little bit of a situation where a couple of other colleges were going to pose very similar programs as to what we're hoping to be able to do. And so the timeline got sped up and moved up by 6 months. And so we are actually presenting to the Community College Commission in October instead of February. And so that has taken my life from a nice, easy coast into the semester to a blistering experience of shenanigans and lots of meetings.
Okay, just because some other colleges want to do a similar program, it started a rat race?
A little bit, yes. Yes, it Why? Expedited the timeline.
Were they ahead of you already, or are they trying to cheat at their finish line?
They are trying to cheat at the finish line. We were ahead.
You want that to be public, do you?
they were trying to get ahead of us because they found out what we were doing. Because the problem is that the first college that gets their degree out there is the program that all the other programs are based off of. So if there's like numbering systems or similar course titles, that type of thing, you have to go into alignment with the first program that's approved by the Higher Education Learning Community or Learning Committee, excuse me. HLC, they're the accrediting institution for most universities around the nation. And the first program that gets approved by them in the state, everybody else has to reference them. And so they are hoping that we are going to be the first program that all the other colleges have to base their programs off of and refer to.
Who's the they that's hoping this?
My administration. So my president and my vice president.
That makes sense. I bet their administrations want them to be first.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure of that.
I love the competitiveness of the world we live in. It's so wonderful.
I honestly, it's making me cringe a little bit because it has the flavor of scarcity mentality all over it, which I am not thrilled about. But what I am thrilled about is I wasn't sure whether my program was going to be able to move forward because there's some shifts in leadership that's taking place at our college. And so they were going to put a pause on pursuing my program. And now, because of their competitiveness and some of the scarcity mentality, they are moving it up instead of putting a pause on it. So that portion I'm okay with, but the catalyzing effect behind it is a little disconcerting.
So that takes what other people are doing for evil and God trying to work it for good. Is that it?
We'll find out. That's what
I'm hoping. One might hope.
So that's a little bit of update about my world.
Good. I just got back from Toronto, spent some time there with folks from a variety of different places on the spiritual journey. Had a great weekend, a lot of really honest fellowship. People kept commenting on that. It's weird. You sit in there in our backyard and people start talking and people go deep quick. People are into trauma stuff and they're into their own spiritual hungers that are lacking. Not the hunger's not lacking, the fruit of it is lacking. And so they're having questions about that. And I love that too. I get someplace, we spend very little time on the kind of small talk to get to know each other. And immediately people are really walking some deep places. So I find that very rewarding to be with people that are willing to explore at that level. And then flew back yesterday.
Do you feel like that level of access and that level of comfort has kind of shifted? Because I know that you talked about when you first had published The Shack and that was really blowing up, that there was more of this, like, we want to talk about The Shack and the celebrity stuff that was around that versus I feel like the last 3 or 4 years have been just a season of very vulnerable honesty of what you've been working through and navigating between you and Sarah and your cancer and all the different elements that you've been sorting out over the last 5 years. That to me has felt like offering a higher level of vulnerability threshold versus the Wayne Jacobson just wrote this amazing book and I want to know the celebrity.
Oh my gosh, I hope we don't compare those two, because those are two entirely different worlds. People who come with a manuscript for me to have, or just because they want to bask in somebody who had something to do with a book I'm deeply touched by. This has much more been more pre-Shaq. That's why to me Shaq's stuff was difficult, because it brought a different kind of person into the conversation, but not so deeply inclined to the knowing of God, but more had other agenda and things. Getting out of that conversation was very helpful, not traveling under the weight of the Shaq, although we still get to talk about the story because people still attach me to it. And so there's lovely, but it seems that we very quickly, people don't come to sit back and listen to Wayne. They come to get my help. They come with stuff they're ready to share. And here's what I'm struggling with, having read enough of your stuff to know that you might have some thoughts in this area to help me. And that's much more rewarding than me sitting there trying to entertain a crowd, which I have long given up doing. They made it back home. Surprisingly, our pilot took a strange detour because he had weather problems in Chicago. So we wandered all over Michigan and down to Indiana and found our way back to Chicago. Flight map at the end, I took a picture of the flight map on the back of the seat in front of me on the video screen. It was hilarious. I've never taken so long to fly to Chicago from Toronto in my life and never hope to again. But fortunately, I had a 2.5 hour layover scheduled in Chicago, so I had plenty of time to make my connection and get home. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. So what is the best thing you've heard in the last month or three?
Well, the best thing that I heard, it actually came up yesterday. I was just listening to a podcast and there was a C.S. Lewis quote that came up that actually really made me think of you, because I was just kind of processing some things and this quote came up. You are never too old to set another goal or to dream a new dream.
Oh, what's an age joke?
It wasn't an age joke. That it was because you've been talking about retiring for a little while now, since
30 years.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah. And what I've loved about walking in our friendship over the last 15 years has been seeing how every time you're like, oh, maybe this is when God has me slow my life down a little bit. There's this new invitation to something different, or a new conversation comes into your world, or a new opportunity, or a new spout of revelation and inspiration comes, and it all of a sudden revitalizes you into this new space. And I love that, because for me, somebody who is about halfway or halfway plus in his life, to be able to see somebody navigating what you have navigated, the different life experiences you've had, the things that you've accomplished, and yet it seems like there's these new invitations that God keeps giving you as you say, oh, I'm going to slow life down. Then it's like, oh, no, well, we're going to do this project, or maybe I'm going to start developing this pathway support thing for people and as a spiritual guide for people with cancer, or I mean, just these different opportunities. And it gave me such delight, because I love that Father keeps creating those invitations, no matter what age you are or what life experience you're in, that those experiences, those opportunities, those gentle nudges and invitations are ever present and continuing to grow. And that, like, that is incredibly encouraging to me.
Oh, intriguing, you say.
That is one word you could use. Yes.
I thought that's what you said. It came up a couple of times when I was traveling. People would mention the word intriguing and everybody would laugh. So
and now it's a thing.
It is a thing. It's a thing among the God Journey crowd. I can always tell, okay, these are the people listening to the God Journey here, because when somebody made a joke about intriguing, some laughed, some didn't. So
oh boy.
And some people tell me they take me seriously when they say, you know, listen for a few years, and when you feel like you get the pace of it, you move on to something else. So they don't listen forever. But I, as I listen to you talk about that, I realize my life constantly finds myself in new places, not just opportunities work-wise, but even spiritual kind of understanding things.
Yes.
It's like exploring a cave and all of a sudden this new cavern opens up. At the same time, the pace of my life is slowing down. I really am enjoying that I'm more slowing to Sarah's pace, as I joked about. That was serious. And then slowing to God's pace, even slower than Sarah's.
Yeah.
And I feel like I am slowing. My days are much less complicated, even though there's more opportunity to explore things. But I'm not letting the more opportunity just add on to things that were there in the past. When something comes up, I let go of something. I find myself a better listener, a better learner when I'm walking at a slower pace. And I wish I'd walked at this pace all my life. It's not a retirement pace. It's just kind of a, God moves so much slower than we think, so much slower than I want him to. And instead of being out front, come on, get over here again. Come join me, God. I just feel like, okay, I'm following you. I'm settling in behind you at your pace instead of harassing you with mine. And that feels really good.
That's what I was going to ask you, was if you view this as a stage of life pace or as a pace that you feel like if you could have walked previously, you would have.
Yes, this would
be more of a desired life rhythm versus a seasonal pace, if that makes sense.
Yeah, more the unforced rhythms of grace instead of chasing opportunity and being harassed by people who want certain things out of you that God hasn't asked you to give, or people you're dragging you into court and having to meet with attorneys for. Yes. I'm glad I don't have that stuff in my life at the moment.
What about you? Best thing you heard this week?
I think I'm going to do this. This is from Theo of Golden. I've seen it on the bestseller list for a long time, and I tend to avoid bestsellers. And then somebody sent me an article about his story being very Shack-like, and that he's in his 70s, published this book on his own, and it kind of gained trajectory, and then another publisher jumped in later. And so his name's Alex Levy, and Theo of Golden is a very people-centric story, very interesting. In it, he has one character who's trying to get some legal advice from non-legal people about forgiving somebody that hurt his daughter in an accident. And then this quote from someone who was advising the father, who was thinking about not pressing maximum charges on the perpetrator, but really find it because it was a mistake on his part and not intentional. And he got this advice: baby, there's justice and there's mercy. If you're not sure what to do, you got to choose one or the other. I always say, go to the mercy way. If you make a mistake, make it for mercy. Bad mercy don't hurt nearly like bad justice. Boy, that is really good. Bad mercy don't hurt nearly like bad justice. And this lady who's the character saying these words is meaning justice in the vengeance way. It's not justice like Toby and I have been talking about it, because that I think justice and mercy go side by side in God's heart, restoration and healing and redemption and all that. But I thought, just if you're in a situation where you've got to really get somebody, let's use the word accountability, hold someone accountable or give mercy, bad mercy is better than bad accountability any day of the week.
That takes me back to a conversation that we just got done having, though, in my family and domestic violence class. We were doing
a fun class. Wow.
Oh, it's ouch. It is a hard class. The content is difficult. It's very heavy, but it is very, very meaningful to people who are preparing to work with other people. And they are conversations that need to be had. And today we were doing a deep dive on the Duggar family and Shiny Happy People and evaluating that case. And one of the big questions that came up was, why did the Duggar parents not bring formal charges of child abuse against their oldest son, who had confessed to molesting at least four of their children? Now, granted, he is in federal prison now for child pornography charges, but when you said that quote, that whole conversation about the Duggar family and not bringing child abuse charges against him, and that was on the front of my mind. And so it's like, okay, I agree with you that bad mercy is better than bad justice or bad accountability. And yet in that case, and then in some other cases that you and I have talked about in the past, there was, oh, we just wanted to be merciful towards people. We wanted to be mercy heavy. It was Bethel in Redding, California, that were, they were in their public apology about the,
they're begging for mercy. Yeah.
Yes. They're saying, well, you know, we were erring on the side of mercy for the abusers, even though we were completely destroying the victims that had come to us for counseling and confidence. And I get it. It's like, Lord, how do you choose, Father? Like, how do you thread that needle? Because that's a hard one, especially as my college students were really wrestling with that and really struggling with how could you be a parent and not want to seek justice for five of your kids, but that justice is at the expense of one of your kids. And the dialogue was pretty intense.
I'm sure it was, and I'm sure it probably was in the family as well as they're dealing with it. I don't think mercy in this case, the one giving mercy is the one who is victimized.
Mm.
I don't think it's a matter of like saying the person who's victimized, you need to give mercy because our friend is the one being accused here. Mercy has to extend as much to the victims as it does to the perpetrator. Mm. And I don't think this quote in the book would apply in this situation we're talking about because this is very different. I can understand a parent not wanting their kid to be in the kind of legal trouble he should have been in. And the hope is, I think of the arrogance of that kind of spirituality is, we can handle this in-house. We will stop it. He's repented. He's sorry. It won't happen again. But then it does happen again. And then someone else in the family gets victimized. And they made a series of mistakes because they put the future of one child ahead of the reality of five other children or four other children.
Oof.
You wouldn't make that decision at the end of the day, right? If you knew, if we don't stop him now, four more of our kids are going to be victimized, you would stop him now, legally.
Yeah.
But you always assume we can navigate this. How many times do we just make excuses to be kind to somebody we love who's hurting other people we love and somehow hope we can manage all that juggling bowling pins in the air when it doesn't work out that way. And this points to that. I think when you're talking about the danger other people had being near that kid and the parents couldn't see it. And I don't know how many parents would see it. I think many of us, like we always say, you want mercy for the person you love. You want vengeance, accountability for the person you don't love.
Yeah.
And that leads to a pretty unweighted legal system because I see that all the time. When the rich get in trouble, they have lawyers and things to get them out of trouble. And then they just perpetuate worse things in our society. And it's just sad to me that our legal system, and we don't seem to care as a country. It's all weighted toward those who have money. And yet we don't, the rest of the population isn't just screaming, what are we doing here? This is not fair to all of us.
Yeah, I think it's really hard when you're talking about people when you're talking about multiple people in that situation that you love, and how do we find the best way through for all parties involved? It wasn't that one person wasn't loved less than the others, but to make that hard choice of we need to protect the rest of our family from this individual because of the choices that they're making and because of some of the tendencies that they have or some of the addictions that they're struggling with or whatever it might be.
Yep.
I think about Sarah's story. I think about my wife's story. I think about other people's stories where when you're wrestling with, okay, how do we figure this out when there's multiple people involved that we care about?
Yes.
And how do we make that decision? And I guess the question that I came away from in that conversation is, Jesus, how do you do this? How, as my loving father and the loving father of the person next to me and the person, how do you navigate that in your love, but then also in your justice and your mercy? Like, how do you figure that out, Lord? How, like, it's a dang good thing that we serve a God that is so beyond us, because my human knowledge, especially in situations like this, I find myself just running into a brick wall and trying to sort it out.
What Toby and I have talked about a lot is inside of God, there is no contest between justice and mercy.
Mm.
In our limited human way of approaching things, there often is. We see one at the expense of the other. Instead of mercy in a situation would apply to all parties. It's not picking out one and favoring them with mercy to the expense of hurt in others. So I think God has this amazing ability and wisdom. And if we lean into him and find out what that might be for us and for our family. But that family was already off track in so many ways. Yeah, they wouldn't have heard God's voice to how to manage the situation with their son. But thinking about that in a variety of ways as to how mercy and justice don't have to be at odds with each other. God's kind of justice. The vengeance thing, yes. Now we're forced to a choice. I'm going to either be vengeful towards you or I'm going to be merciful towards you. And Jesus always invited us to choose mercy over sacrifice, over everything else, over obedience at one point. Choose mercy over sacrifice in terms of sacrificing yourself obediently. But we don't have the human wisdom for that. One of the things we talked about in our last class was this beautiful moment where these two prostitutes in Solomon's kingdom are fighting over which baby belongs to whom. Yeah. And one, they both had babies within 3 days of each other. One mother lays on top of her child, not intentionally at night. The baby suffocates and dies. She gets up and trades babies with the other mother. And then the other mother wakes up thinking her baby died. And she's very sad. And she's, you know, and then she realized, oh, this is my baby. This doesn't look like my baby. This is not my baby. And the other, so they have to go to Solomon, each woman claiming that the live baby is theirs and the dead baby belongs to the other. And Solomon, who'd prayed for Mishpat, as Toby says, it was not that kind of wisdom like he wanted to know the knowledge of the cosmos and the stars and all those kinds of things. It was the discernment of justice is what Solomon asked for. Hmm. And because he wanted to rule well over the people, which is not, yeah, it wouldn't be the old, I'm the authority and I'm going to get my way, but how do I help people live justly with each other? And so his determination, after talking to them, getting both their stories, he comes up with this great idea. Tell you what, why don't we just cut the baby in half and each of you get half a baby, half the live baby. Well, the baby's not alive after that. And so what Solomon seemed to know is the mother to whom the child doesn't belong, she sees that as equity, right? I lost my baby. She loses hers. That's all fair.
Yep.
And the other mother's going, no, you're going to kill my kid. No, I'll give it to her. That's what she said. Give it to the other lady. And that's when someone says, okay, well, now I know exactly whose baby this is. And there's a beautiful reality to how love and justice in God's heart can get to resolutions that are fair and honest and right. Because you said that coming into what makes it right for everybody. Most of our justice is not what's right for everybody.
Yeah.
And our rights as a culture often conflict with other people's rights in the culture. And the joy of finding those bits of wisdom that open the door to what's really going on here, I just find breathtaking in Scripture. That to me is justice applied in a beautiful way. And Solomon didn't make the decision. He actually set up a situation in which the women made the decision, exposed where their hearts really were and what the truth really was. And I think it might be more of that as we follow Jesus and have conversations with people that kind of expose where lies are, exposes where truth is, where love reigns. That to me is, this is why you cannot codify that into law. Law is just something people on either side with their attorneys exploit. It's not a matter of getting to what's true and just and right for all concerned. Mm. And certainly the Duggards miss that. But when you're talking about the family domestic violence, whatever you're doing during the day, God bless you. I'm glad I'm not involved in that kind of thing. At least not on that side of things. I got this poem from somebody. It was called Elsewhere by Jessica Jocelyn.
Okay.
I want to know what you thought of this. When I read it, I thought, it'd be interesting to see what Kyle thinks. The tragedy of children is that they will call anything love if it comes from their mother. They will gently and longingly touch the bruises on their hearts because the hands that wounded them also tuck them in at night.
Oof.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness. I think about that with religious abuse, spiritual abuse, the
Yeah.
Pastor who lovingly maybe led you into a relationship with God is now the one bashing you with legalism and you don't know what to do. You're caught between that. That's quite a conflict. When it comes from mother or dad or grandpa or whatever, the loving hands are also the abusing hands. And that creates a real conflict in people's hearts.
It does. And it really twists their perspective of memory, especially around good emotion. So memories around love, memories around kindness, memories around the idea of justice, memories around the idea of compassion. Because one of the videos that one of my students brought up was on Shiny Happy People. There's this video of Bill Gothard publicly teaching how to spank a child in front of the audience. And as he is publicly teaching the audience how to spank the child, he's wanting to show two things. You're spanking the child, and he's doing it softly because it's not his child, but he talks about...
He has a real child, though. He's not using a doll or something?
No, he's using a real child that he pulls from the audience.
Oh, gosh.
And then proceeds to, while he's spanking, is also teaching the parent how to positively affirm the child. So you're going to do great things. You are well loved. You are care. All the while, you are physically spanking this child. Then he lets the kid up, asks the kid for a hug. The kid gives him a very half-hearted hug, and he says, "Oh, well, I guess we need to give you some more spankings. That wasn't a very good hug." And it was like all sense of agency, all sense of perspective on what healthy relationships look like. And this is in the context to one of the people that was a part of Gothard's teachings, who literally wrote a book on spanking, is talking about using objects to create bruises that are literally causing physical bodily harm to the child through the spanking process because it's so aggressive. And so it's like, that was the conversation in class today, is how would that twist your perspective of what it means to be loved if somebody is sitting there hitting you with a rod because you didn't adhere to their principles or their rules or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
You deviated from that. So they're hitting you with this rod at the same time affirming that you're going to be a great person, that you are well loved, that you are it. I mean, the amount of mental gymnastics and distortion that is occurring in that moment, and to be espoused from a pulpit as a positive, healthy way of interacting with a child was mind-blowing.
And very common back in the day when I was a young parent.
Absolutely. Incredibly common.
The first church I was in taught, you never spank the child with your hand because that personalizes it. You use a wooden spoon or something so that the child knows it's not coming from the parent. It's coming from the spoon. I'm thinking, okay, this is brainwashing, right? You're absolutely doing one thing and denying it in the same breath. So you're ghosting somebody right in the middle of the moment. And you've got one thing going and you're creating, oh my goodness. You're creating people not to conclude what the child would normally conclude. I'm being abused here, to I'm being loved here. And so many, you know, spare the rod, spoil a child. There was so much of that talk back in the day. And then when the world started saying, hey, this is child abuse, boy, the Christians really went to battle to protect their right to spank their kids. And it was all seemed so normal back then. Oh, gee, God forgive us.
This has been a conversation that Jess and I have wrestled with around spanking and what does that look like? And is there a healthy way to do that? And because both Jess and I were spanked when we were growing up. And so there was just this idea of like, okay, how do you navigate this? And yet the big part of it is how do we help people understand what love is when it's coming from our own broken, twisted perspective of what love is? I mean, God has done a lot of work in my life, a lot of work in my heart. And I already know that I've jacked it up on multiple occasions with my daughters. Like, I know I have. I can think back to instances where I was like, oof, man, that was not a bright and shining moment with.
Well, it might have been in the Gothard sense of a bright, shiny moment.
Oh, geez. Good Lord. I hope not. Ugh. Yuck. I remember I was driving home and Eliana was in the back of the car and she was screaming at the top of her lungs because she didn't get something. And so she's screaming. And so then I matched her scream with my own scream, and it wasn't at her. It just was screaming along with her and just watching the fear wash over her of I'm having this big emotional response. Then all of a sudden I'm jolted out of my response because I'm seeing what my brain is translating as a much more aggressive and violent and hostile response from my dad. And I remember seeing that wash over her and my heart just getting shredded, thinking, oh my gosh, Lord, what did I just do to my daughter? And so I think that's the hard thing, is walking through the stewardship of representing love, whether that be to the children in our lives or the people that we are aspiring to show and introduce to God's kingdom. That is a heavy weight. It just is to me.
It's very normal, though, for young parents to not divide well between their love and responsibility to discipline with managing their personal frustration.
Yeah,
that'd be true for me. I get very frustrated because kids know better. And now you're doing this. And then so my frustration's merging with their disobedience, and they're just being kids and making mistakes. And rather being kind and gracious about that, I look back at even the spoon thing we talked about. That's how we were told to spank kids.
Yeah.
So we did. And one time I noticed one of my kids, and we'll say which one, was screaming louder than I thought it merited. And so I finished up with that, you know, and got dealt with him, always affirmed him in love. And, you know, I'm sorry. It was never, I'm doing good things to you here. I said, man, I hate doing this.
Yeah.
But I love you. And then when they left the room, I hit myself with that spoon. It was so painful, way more than I thought it was. At least if you spank with your hand, you get pretty good feedback as to how much this is dealing with it.
Yep.
And we never did again. I stopped. So we're going to find other ways to create the kind of disciplined discomfort rather than it being through physical pain.
Yeah.
Because it's so easy to let your frustration bleed over into it, particularly with kids you've told 1,500 times, please stop doing this, please stop doing this, please stop doing this. And back in the day, before I got a good dose of what it meant to live loved a bit, frustration was a more frequent occupant of my heart than being at rest in who God is and who God's made me to be.
Yeah. So. And I think this really comes back to what you and I were talking about a little earlier about the pace.
Yep.
When I fail the most to convey love and care and compassion to my daughters, or to my wife, or to the people around me, is when my pace is a lot faster.
Yeah.
When I feel like I'm late, or I'm behind, or I'm exhausted, and there's other things that I am trying to get done or accomplish, the pace that I have does not create space or ability for me to be that gentle, kind, caring person. It leads to aggravation. It leads to frustration. It leads to shortness of temper, all the different things that I don't want to have as a part of my life. And yet this summer was a very eye-opening thing for me because I got to operate at my daughter's pace and I did not have any other responsibilities. I was off from work. I was off from work. There wasn't a whole lot that was demanding of my time. And yet, watching how I filled it, watching how I prioritized, watching still how I asked my daughters, no, you have to adhere to my pace all the time, which sometimes they need to. Sometimes they need, oh, no, we need to go at dad's pace today. versus no, this is Eliana or this is Evie's day, and I'm going to be at their pace, whatever that looks like for the day. And man, I just found myself in moments being like, Kyle, why are you driving this? There's no need to drive this. There's literally nothing else in your day today that you have to do other than be present with your daughter.
Yep.
So why are you agitated? Why are you frustrated? Why are you annoyed here? And it was very much about me recalibrating to from working full time, being a husband, taking care of myself, loving my daughters, all those different pieces to no, I'm just present with my daughter and I'm just walking at her pace today. And gosh, the calibration was rough there for a little bit in regards to me trying to slow things down and recalibrate to being like, no, there needs to be allowance here. There needs to be space here. There is literally no reason for there not to be margin here. That is a you thing, Kyle. If there is not margin, that is absolutely a you thing.
Yeah. And you could see that just going through an airport. You know, if you've got,
oh my gosh, yes,
two hours between connections, you can saunter down the terminal. But if you're like the first time I land in Chicago on the way to Toronto, they switched the gate of our plane four different times.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I plan to get some things done at the airport. So I'm moving around and now people are obstacles when you're trying to rush. And yeah, that's what I love. I used to love about travel back in the day was life at home was always rushed. I always had a million things to do in 100,000 minutes of time. Yeah. And now when you travel and you get somewhere, now it's just whatever they're doing, whatever pace is here. I don't have an agenda apart from whatever we're doing. I didn't, you know, rush down, have a conversation with people for 2 hours and then rush up to my room and write some more stuff. I just didn't. And I used to love that. Now I notice when going there this weekend, my pace on the road is pretty much similar to the pace I have at home.
Ooh.
So it wasn't like a bit of a vacation. Yeah. But I don't have to. I'm really enjoying the pace of life I get to live right now. And and if people were here early on, the cost of slowing down, the duration of time it takes to learn to live at a different pace, they would know this is not something you just go to God and say, oh, Jesus, could you help me slow down? Thank you very much. And then I'm going to be, you know, it's just not that. It's the lessons of what God needs to stir in someone's heart for that to happen. I was talking to Lewis this morning. I shared some of his story on the blog yesterday, and some of you maybe picked up on that story. But I was asking him, I said, anything else going on there? And he's had some more night terrors this week. And one of them, Jesus is there, and he's aware of all that's been going on. He says, Jesus, is there another way to do this, to free me from this stuff?
Yeah.
And Jesus' answer, which I thought was unique, he said, not organically. And so I asked Lewis, I said, so what did you take that to mean? He said,
yeah,
I wasn't sure. I don't know what that, like organic is from the ground, right? I said, okay, so what does that mean for you? He goes, I don't know. I said, no, organically means there's one thing for Jesus to take your night terrors away. There's another thing for him to unwind the cause of them inside of you. That's the organic. And he said, I can't really set you free if I don't do it organically. And that's so true in my life. That's been so true. The things anxiety used to be big in my life. Anger used to be big in my life. And you beg God to take those away and you wonder why he doesn't. Why don't you just take these away from me?
Yes.
And I love that. That's what I've discovered in my own journey as well, that it's the organic transformation over time and over lessons learned in the immediacy of events that you're involved in and learning to find the way of Jesus rather than the way of Wayne. And it is a long, slow, dare we say, arduous process. But then when the freedom comes, it really comes. God didn't just take it away. He took the cause of it away by enlarging himself inside our own experience. And man, I love that so much. So touching.
Yeah, it's almost like I was thinking about that, and the image that I had was just like God's already clipped the roots like if there's a crazy vine that would have wrapped itself all over, like that was the image, was this vine was wrapped all over stuff. And then there was the roots that were tied into the ground that were providing sustenance for that vine and clip the roots. But that doesn't mean it doesn't take a long time to pull that plant, to pull that vine off of everything that it's wound itself around, even as parts of it are dying. Yeah. Even if parts of it are starting to shrivel up and don't have as much authority, don't have as much influence, don't have as much of its own life that's strangling your heart.
Yeah.
It still takes some time to get all that pulled away.
Yeah. And even when you cut it off and kill it, the vine dying becomes more rigid.
Yes.
Not
more supple. Harder to get off. Yeah.
Yeah. It hardens as it's dying. And I think we miss this process. When he said that to me about Jesus said it wouldn't be organic or you need to do it organically, I just went, oh man, that just makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And why we miss that, why we're such in a hurry to fix the problem or to pretend we don't have the problem instead of really let Jesus get inside the problem and unwind it from in our hearts so that we can actually live differently. Because as I said, those, you take all the night terrors away and the source of them is still inside you, twisting the relationships around you.
Yeah.
And he just said, oh my gosh, that's really beautiful. And I said, it is. God getting inside of us and reordering. And I don't think it's, I mean, for me, I look at things, he's kind of unwinding still this source of my life. And I wish he'd done it in my 20s. And yet somehow God's not disturbed by how long it takes us to learn to follow and cooperate with him and let him. And I don't imagine there won't be things he's unwinding up till the day I die. Because as he unwinds some things from my life, then suddenly there's other things that I didn't realize were that much of a connection to pacing. And then that begins to unwind. And that becomes, each time it just becomes a bigger exhale. Oh man, I'm glad that that's not what it used to be in my heart.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing that I have in that regard is when it's people that I love that are in pain and I'm watching them go through that thing or that experience, knowing that God is a good God, knowing his heart is good for the people that I love and that I care about, but that process, the idea that God isn't in a rush, that he doesn't operate under the tyranny of the urgent by any means. Mm-mm. And yet at times I'm like, yeah, Lord, but you do realize that they're in a lot of pain right now. You do realize that the things that they're going through right now are incredibly disruptive to how they are living. Yep. And even though I know that you're healing them, even though I know that you're bringing them into restoration, even though I know that you're clipping the roots of the vine and you're pulling the tendrils of that vine off of their heart, they're still in a lot of pain from that vine.
And pain doesn't seem to disturb God near as much as it disturbs us.
Yeah.
Even the pain we export to others in our brokenness and fallenness, if I get to the root of it and unwind it from you, your freedom will inure to great benefit to people.
Yeah.
But I can't just let this go on. I do want to bring you into freedom. And that's usually because we've asked him to, you know, God, whatever it takes, come at me. And then we regret it in the middle of it when it's not as quick, free, or painless as we thought it was when we were praying to him about it.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.